Well, good morning to everyone. It's good to see you. Glad to have the chance to speak with you and to look at God's Word with you this morning. I'm gonna be continuing today with a lesson on the broad topic of family, and that the church is a family that God has made us to be together. And I want to talk about the idea of trust and what that's about and how we learn trust and what goes into losing trust or gaining trust and thinking about that. It's oddly not in the word itself. Maybe there's a few synonyms that can be translated trust, but the word doesn't show up a tremendous amount of times in the New Testament, but it's in the Old Testament a whole lot, and it's almost only used in connection with God, that we trust God. But there's a lot of examples of trusting in family or in brothers and sisters and in each other, and that's something I want to think about. The passage here in Matthew 27 is, I think, an interesting one. He trusts in God, let God deliver him now if he desires him, for he said, I am the Son of God. This is someone mocking that, someone who is mocking trust. And I thought, what an odd inclusion, because the reality was is that Jesus did indeed trust in God. God did indeed deliver Jesus after he died on the cross, but that trust was something that outlasted the faith that those men who spoke with it had. And I think that that's an interesting idea. I don't want to spend too long here in Ephesians, but this is where I like to start when I'm talking about trust. In Ephesians chapter 4, I'm just going to read the first three verses. Ephesians 4, verse 1. I therefore, a prisoner of the Lord, urge you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which you've been called, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another in love, eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. I think all those commands there could well fit the idea of how to love or how to trust. I see a lot of similarity in the words love and trust. One is going to require or is often including the other. But this concept of walking with humility and gentleness and patience and bearing with one another, those are all words that are maybe used to describe the ideas of trusting. But what I think is really interesting is that God has made us to be united. We might not be united, but God made us united. And I think that that's a really interesting idea. I think that we're united, but the Spirit has made us united, and in verse 3, we need to be eager to maintain that. So there's an interesting relationship that we have here with God. He did it, and we also work at it. We do it, or we engage in that, and we maintain that. And I think that that's curious. We can't make something more united than what God makes. And there's a lot of ideas and clubs and things that are out there where people come together and they're united. But what God makes to be united is going to be the best, and it's going to be the greatest. But even so, there's a responsibility placed on us to maintain that. And at the end of this section, down in verses 15 and 16, we get more instructions connected to that. Rather, speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up in every way into him who is the head, into Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and held together with every joint with which it is equipped, when each part is working properly, makes the body grow so that it builds itself up in love. So we need to be engaged in this. We need to speak truth in love. We need to build, we build ourselves. We work on this together, and we have a lot to do. And these words aren't about trust, but this is what I was thinking about. Above all these things, we put on love. That's the thing that binds us together. So love and trust, I believe, are key components to the unity and really are going to be key components to the family that God has made us to be. So that's just a background idea that I think is helpful to think about. Where do we learn trust? Where do we understand trust? We're going to look at this in a moment, if you want to turn to Psalm 22. Psalm 22:9 talks about that. I believe that we learn trust at the hand of God in the arms of our family. Incidentally, if you're doing the worksheet with this, I think I took a couple lines out of the PowerPoint because I wanted the words bigger. So if there's a line missing up there, good luck filling in the blank. But We learn trust from God. God places us in family, and that's how we learn it. This is a lot like the way that we learn love. Beloved, let us love one another, for love is from God, and whoever loves has been born of God and knows God. How do we understand love? We don't do it first. We experience it. We receive it at an age when we're probably unconscious of it. And we start to grapple and understand and get to a point where we give out love. And I believe that there's a strong similarity between that and how we learn trust. And in Psalm 22, I had y'all move there, but I never went there myself. I'm not going to read the whole psalm right now, but I want to read verses 1 through 11. My God, why have you forsaken me? This doesn't sound like a psalm about trust. The word trust is in here a whole bunch. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me from the words of my groaning? Oh, my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night, but I find no rest. Yet you are holy, enthroned on the praises of Israel. In you our fathers trusted. They trusted, and you delivered them. To you they cried and were rescued. In you they trusted and were not put to shame. I am a worm and not a man, scorned by mankind and despised by the people. All who see me mock me, and they make mouths at me. They wag their heads. He trusts in the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, for he delights in him. Yet you are he who took me from the womb. You made me trust you at my mother's breasts. On you was I cast from my birth, and from my mother's womb you have been my God. Be not far from me, for trouble is near, and there is none to help. From day one, and technically from before day one, we have been in God's hands. And we learn trust. This psalm is using it as an illustration, but I think that it teaches it. We learn trust in the family. This is where we get these ideas. From our first breath, we're in God's hands. And before we are able to breathe, in the womb, we are in God's hands. We learn to trust in our mother's arms as God cares for us and nurses our needs. God provided the mother that nurses. God works that way. I believe that the family is the seat and the foundation by which we can come to an understanding of what trust is. That's where we first experience it. This is how God chose to teach and to reveal trust to us. And so when he's talking about us being a family, we need to think about that. Trust is this belief in reliability. And the key word there is belief. It's a belief in reliability. It's not the truth of reliability. It's a belief. It's a faith. And that's what makes trust complicated and difficult. It's a belief in reliability, a dependence on something. There's hope there. It's not absolute. That's why we trust it. We trust that it's going to be that way. Now, the reality check here is that the reliability of family is limited. Great families can only be trusted so far. And if we're not in a great family, we're going to have that much less. And so this is a complicated idea, but God teaches trust in all families. He works with all families and in all families. And in a family that didn't do a very good job, he was still there teaching members of that family what the idea of trust is. And they might have learned some bad examples, but that's where you learn it. And so we get funny things like loyalty among siblings. You guys know me fairly well. You know, one of my brothers, there's this magical brother that nobody has ever seen, so I can't really talk about the Bunting siblings, but you also know another set of siblings that starts with a B. I won't say their name, but they starts with a B and ends with Esicker. And they are full of loyalty to and for and with each other right while they are driving each other insane. And that is this wonderful example of why family is this beautiful mess. We learn ideas of trust from the very ones who you don't want to trust to be in a dark room with you because they're going to do something to you. They know how to push the buttons. And that's what makes this really interesting and complicated. God chose to give us family from way early on so that we will learn the ideas of trust even if the family isn't doing it right. Because you're still going to learn a lot about it from that family. There's faithfulness to a clan despite the past. These are ideas that we see. And so trust becomes defined or described or understood in our hearts and our minds because of our family experiences. We learn trust by experiences in family, and this includes bad experiences, but we learn nonetheless. This is how we have, again, learned love. It's not that we have loved God, but that he loved us. And so we learn what love is like because of what we have received and experienced from God and from others. And from others who loved us poorly, we will still love, we will still learn love there as well. And so this is where I believe trust is taught and understood and experienced, and we have categories in our mind what is right about trust and what is wrong about trust, and maybe some people learn a lot and of good things, and maybe some of us aren't blessed that way, and we learn a lot of the bad things, and we have a lot of fears or concerns about trust, but we're still learning about it. So how is it created? Again, in that family, it's created in what I think is, and like to call, very simple family experience or experiences. It's not by the miraculous. It's not by the dramatic. It's by tying strings. So trust doesn't happen just because, for instance, of the miracle of birth. Because there is trust in adoption. And so if a parent adopts a child and they have trust with each other, it's not the miracle of birth or even the miracle of adoption. It's because of the daily effort and the daily showing up, the tying strings image. And this is one thing that I like to think about. I think I got this idea from my wife about when you're building relationship and training up a child and having these things that are going on, you build this with a child not because you do the great big thing and take them to the park, that special park, or you build the giant object, but because you read that book 15 times in a row every day, and you don't like that book anymore. It's because you read the same book only once for 15 weeks every night. Like, that's what it is going to come from. It's because you provide food 3 times a day every day, every year, and the clean clothes, and the clean home. Trust is rooted, I believe, and grows out of what we call the thankless tasks. It's the service. It's the love. So trust is learned in the family, for better or for worse. It's also learned in our other families, in our work family, in our school family, in our, on our team, in the club. These are other families. We talk about them that way. And we learn other aspects of trust in those environments. And so what you can do to learn about trust, if you don't feel like you have a lot of good experiences, or maybe you have good ones and you want to know what are bad experiences, read the Bible stories. Read about families. Read about the soldiers and the men at arms. Read about the prophets and read about the apostles and read about Jesus. Read about their events when they were betrayed or when they stood up for each other. Look what they did with and what they received from others. And you can learn a lot about trust. One idea about trust is that you cannot expect or demand trust. We have been made united. We have to be eager to maintain that. So if we have to be working to maintain unity, we're going to have to work to maintain trust. We are commanded to love. But when we are commanded often, love your enemies, that's not the phileo love, that's that agape love. We call that the higher order love because it has a love that might be devoid of emotion, but it is a duty and is even helping those who hurt me. But that is different from the phileo, the relationship, the brotherly love. So there might be instances where I am loving my enemy, but I don't trust my enemy. We have to be wise as serpents. We have to know, well, this is someone I need to love, but I need to be careful when I'm around them. They might do something to me. That doesn't mean I don't love them. We might say, well, I trust that they're going to say bad things to me because we know what's going on. Look at Acts chapter 9. I love this example of trust struggling. Acts chapter 9, starting in verse 26. And when Paul, or Saul still at this time, when Saul had come to Jerusalem, he attempted to join the disciples, and they were all afraid of him, for they did not believe that he was a disciple. But Barnabas took him and brought him to the apostles and declared to them how on the road he had seen the Lord who spoke to him, and how at Damascus he had preached boldly in the name of Jesus. So he went in and out among them in Jerusalem, preaching boldly in the name of the Lord. There is the problems and the difficulties and the growth of trust in action. They were all afraid of him. They didn't believe him. I don't think you're a disciple. That's just your sneaky way to come in here and arrest us all. And it's going to take a lot of work. This is where Satan can keep working, right? He's doing really well. He doesn't want the disciples to get together. And he wants to keep Saul away from them. Or he wants Saul to feel bad. Oh, I should never go with those people because I hurt them before. And so that's where Satan comes in and ruins things. Trust is connected to love. Sometimes we need to love, and we might even have to love before we have a lot of trust. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, and endures all things. But it might not overnight show a change like that. And so we have to be careful. You can't just demand, well, you need to trust me. Ooh, that's hard to do. God does want me to trust you, but it's hard to make those demands. But we have been made to be a family, and we need to dig deep into our muscle memory of how family works so that we can work on that and build on that. What did Barnabas do? Barnabas took him and brought him to the apostles. Barnabas, like a brother, went and listened to Saul, his brother. They talked to each other like brothers, probably yelling at each other a little bit, not believing each other at first, but trying to figure this out. And so Barnabas, like a brother, took his brother to the rest of his family. And that family, probably at arm's length, listened leaning backwards because there's not a lot of trust, but they listened to a brother talking about a brother and eventually believed that brother. So that was probably very, very hard. You read about this in just a few verses. Do you think it took 30 minutes? Or maybe 30 minutes a day for 30 days? It doesn't say how long this was. But I imagine it would have been slow. Which one of them went out on a limb on this? Barnabas went out on a limb to speak to Saul, to listen to him. Saul went out on a limb to be willing to talk to Barnabas because he just got rejected by everybody. Barnabas goes out on a limb to talk to the rest of the Christians about a guy that they don't like and they don't trust. Everyone at church goes out on a limb to listen to Barnabas, let alone everybody here. Everyone here has to do something, and everyone is risking trouble. Right? It's risky. It's not easy. It's not always safe. This is vulnerability, right? Love and trust demands vulnerability. Which one of the people here was vulnerable? Every single one of them. I mean, maybe some feel the vulnerability more than others, but they all had to go through this in order for it to come out to be something good. What if Saul just said, all right, whatever. I'm sure they're good people. I'll just go work over here and they'll work over there. That wouldn't have been right. And think about all the problems that showed up in the rest of the New Testament story. Paul needed those people, and they needed him. I got this definition out of a book, the courage to show up when you cannot control the outcome. I like that as a definition of vulnerability. There's a lot of people who need to control everything around them so that they can feel safe. Well, it snowed. None of y'all stopped that from happening. We can't control everything. Here's another quotation. It's a little bit longer. To love is to be vulnerable. Love anything in your heart will certainly be wrung and possibly broken. If you want to make sure of keeping it intact, you must give your heart to no one, not even to an animal. Wrap it carefully round with hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all entanglements. Lock it up safe in the casket or coffin of your selfishness. But in that casket, safe, dark, motionless, and airless, it will change. It won't be broken, but it will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable. In order to be human, we must relate and share and communicate. And in order to do that, we have to endure difficulties and hurts in order to gain that which is wonderful. And so we're going to gain and grow and feed trust every single time we show up for each other. Which one was Jesus' mother and brother and sister? The ones who showed up, the ones who listened. Every time we show up, we are feeding trust. You can trust me more, and I can trust you more. Every time we show up to church, to class, to a study, every time you show up at a meal or at a get-together or at a potluck or at a pitch-in if you're in Indiana, every time you show up by providing or caring or sending something to somebody, you might not get as many birthday cards as you want, but you know somebody who's going to send you a birthday card every single year. Showing up by opening your own home to somebody with love. I'll be honest, if you're not at church, you're not going to be able to trust or be trusted very well. I mean, it's not a one-to-one, but there is a relation there. I have been here a little over 2 years. Do you trust me more? If I've been here for 10 years, chances are there could be more trust. I mean, because the more contact, the more interaction, the more relation. That's the way it works. You have to show up for them if you want them to trust you. And you need to show up by letting them show up for you. You need to let people in. There's no fast track. This is slow and painful. Probably painful mostly because it's so slow. But I want it right now. Yep, we all do. But it's a slow process. There is loss of trust. In this section of my notes, I have go fast because I don't want to slow down here. How is trust lost? Man, I don't even know. Trust is connected to the heart, and the heart is insane, right? You just can't predict all these sorts of things. Go to 2 Corinthians chapter 3. The heart flips back and forth. Trust is going to be, since it's connected to that, flip around a bit too. In 2 Corinthians chapter 3, again, this is after Paul had been in Corinth for, I think, a year and a half. He's written a letter that we don't have. We have 1 Corinthians. Here's this other letter. He's about to go there. We know that he was there with them for a longer time than a lot of other places. And he writes here in 2 Corinthians 3, "Are we beginning to commend ourselves again, or do we need, as some do, letters of recommendation to you or from you? You yourselves are our letter of recommendation, written on our hearts, to be known and read by all. And you show that you are a letter from Christ, delivered by us, written not with ink, but with the Spirit of the living God on tablets of stone, not on tablets of stone, but on tablets of human hearts." They were a great demonstration of who Paul was as a teacher. They were someone that he could brag about. "Oh, you can trust me, I'm a good teacher. Look at how well Corinth can be and is." And when he's turning around to Corinth, they're saying, "Well, let me see your resume." He says, "You are my resume." What's going on here? How did they forget what Paul is, right? Or did they lose it? I think that this is an interesting story here. Something got in and pushed Paul out. And as we read through 2 Corinthians, there's a lot of ideas that I think can fit into that. But I'm just thinking the way things work today. Bad teaching, teams, the polarization, the politics, South versus North, East versus West, in-group, out-group, tall versus short, I don't know. Any of these things get in and elbow out things we already know. And so this can happen. I think Paul is trying to tell them and tell us today that we need to wake up and think about the way we're thinking. Turn a few pages over to chapter 6. I'm going to start reading in verse 11. "We have spoken freely to you, Corinthians. Our heart is wide open. You're not restricted by us, but you are restricted in your own affections. In return, I speak as to children, widen your hearts also." Paul said, I didn't do anything like this to you. He's about to get into in the next chapter about how he said, y'all are doing this wrong. And yes, that hurt you, but it hurt you towards change. And that's not the problem, that I said things that hurt your feelings because you were sinning. There's something else. Your heart isn't wide enough to accept me, Paul. And that's a big problem. Look down at chapter 7, verse 2. Make room in your hearts for us. We've wronged no one. We've corrupted no one. We've taken advantage of no one. I do not say this to condemn you, for I said before that you are in our hearts to die together and to live together. I am acting with great boldness toward you. I have great pride in you. I am filled with comfort. In all our affliction, I am overflowing with joy. That great boldness that he had, what was he being bold about? To puff up his chest and be willing to talk to them? It sounds like vulnerability to me. This is a dangerous group of people to talk to if that's the way they feel about him. But he's doing what he needs to say to them to get them to wake up to him. We need to think about what we're doing. Trust is created and nourished and taught, and it all comes from God, and it goes into our relationships with each other. In Philippians chapter 2, verse 12, it says, "Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling." Wow, do it myself? It is God who is at work in you, both to will and to work to his good pleasure. I think trust is going to be the same way. We need to go out on a limb and try and reach and care and love and do these sorts of things, knowing that God fulfills that in us and in others. There's that great line in Romans, "So as far as it depends on you, live at peace with all men." Sometimes we're going to give and give and give, and it's not going to happen. But then we go and we find other places and we find other people and we work at it, and God is there to nourish and help us. I want to close by looking at a really simple story. When I was thinking about trust and a guy sinking in the water, there's an aspect of this story that I hadn't thought of before. So in Matthew chapter 14, the story of Peter walking on the water. I'll go ahead and read the full story, 22 through 33. "Immediately he made the disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he dismissed the crowds. And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone, but the boat by this time was a long way from the land, beaten by the waves, for the wind was against them. And in the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. But when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified and said, 'It's a ghost!' They cried out in fear, but immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, 'Take heart, it is I, do not be afraid.' And Peter answered him, 'Lord, if it is you, command me to come out to you in the water, on the water.' And he said, 'Come.' So Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came to Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, 'Lord, save me.' And immediately Jesus reached out his hand and took hold of him, saying to him, 'O you of little faith, why did you doubt?' And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased, and those in the boat worshiped him, saying, 'Truly you are the Son of God.'" I like this story. It's the ultimate sermon story. You don't even have to say anything. It just works. And Jesus says, "O you of little faith, why did you doubt?" Right? Peter, I love the line, he sees the wind. We know what that means. But he sees the wind and he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cries out. And Jesus says, "O you of little faith, why did you cry out?" So when his faith failed, what did he do? What did Peter have left? He still had trust. And I think that that's really curious. He's sinking in the water, and he doesn't reach for the boat. He reaches for the other guy walking on water, because he's not just some other guy. Let's say he's doubting the power of Jesus and he's doubting the miracle. I don't know. He's losing his faith. But he reaches out to the one who has the power. I don't think because he thinks Jesus is better at miracles than me. He just trusts Jesus. It's the gut reaction. When you are training for an emergency circumstance, the reason you do that training is so that when the event happens, you do it without thinking. I was on the wrestling team, and we would do these drills, and over again, do this with the arm, do this with the leg, do this with the arm, do this with the leg, so that when you're in the middle of a match, you don't think your arms and legs are doing it before your brain is telling your arms and legs to do it. And that's something special about trust here, that Peter called out to Jesus, who had the power that he was beginning to fail in his trust somehow. I don't know the right words for this, but faith was failing, but trust was still there. We're going to be out there in the world, and our faith is going to be shocked whether someone has a good argument that we don't know how to answer, or some tragedy hits us, or hits a loved one. And it's making us feel unsettled. It's making us doubt. It's making us wonder. But what we still have is trust. If we've been coming together and being together, we're going to have trust with each other, and we're going to have trust with God. And some event's going to happen that's going to blow up my relationship with one or two of you, and we're going to be rocked and shuddering, and our trust and our relationship will be on the rocks, but we will have trust in other directions that we will reach out to so that we can figure this out. Or something happens between you and me, and I go, what did they do? This is totally wrong. They are a mess, but I have so much background trust that we can work this out. And that's really what this is all about in being a family. Do you trust God's hand? Peter did. He's sinking in the water. Oh no, the water is swallowing me up. Let me reach out to the guy who's not being swallowed by the water, who's supplying the power that I'm beginning to doubt, right? The irony there is kind of weird. I trust in God's hand, but the hand that God is giving me might be yours. And to trust in God might mean trusting in you. Or to trust in God might mean you trusting in me. And that's a big deal, because we're not family by circumstance. We're family by choice. God made us to be together. God brought us together. We might make some choices about where we move and different communities that we're a part of. But God has put us together, and we make those decisions to be together. And we need to be eager to maintain that bond of unity together so that we can be safe together in God. I'm just going to read the short psalm. Read Psalm 22 on your own. It is about the trust of God. But it does teach a lot about that. It's the psalm that Jesus quotes when he's on the cross, and people wonder if God was somebody that Jesus could not trust in. But it's a psalm about trust and holding on to God. I don't think the word trust shows up in Psalm 133. But 133 is a wonderful psalm about unity and relationship. It's also a hilarious psalm. Psalm 133. Behold how good and pleasant it is when brothers dwell in unity. It's like the precious oil on the head, running down on the beard of Aaron, running down on the collar of his robes. It's like the dew of Hermon, which falls on the mountains of Zion. For there the Lord has commanded the blessing, life forevermore. I love this psalm. Number one, I think it's hilarious. The metaphor of oil running all over my head is not necessarily that appealing to me, and it always makes me chuckle. And the dew on the mountain, I think of getting wet tennis shoes when I'm hiking. So the metaphors aren't necessarily, pulling at my heartstrings. But the message is still there. Wonder just how wonderful and how pleasant it is when we are dwelling together in unity. And God supplies metaphors that make us laugh. God gave us family, and sometimes family makes us laugh and cry. But God gave us to be something, to be together. It's going to be a lot of work, and it's going to be a slow labor, but it is always fruitful, and it is always blessed by God. So if you're struggling with that, if you're struggling in your own family or in this family, that's a part of life, but we need to do better at that. And not just accept those struggles and work on what can I do to grow and what can I do with this sister or this brother who needs help in growth. And I want to pray with you about that, and we all need to pray with each other about that. If you're not saved, this is a family you want to be a part of. You want Jesus as your brother. You want God as your father. You're going to get the rest of us as sisters and brothers too, but you'll dwell on the fact that you'll have Jesus as a brother. He will never fail you, even if we make mistakes. God is ready to welcome you into his family. If there's anyone here who needs prayer or saving today, why don't you come forward as we stand and sing?